Turn, please, to 1 Samuel, chapter 22. 1 Samuel, chapter 22. Follow as I read the entire chapter. As Roger mentioned, from the life of that man of God in the Old Testament, the apple of God's eye, David. Certain where that is. When Saul heard that David was discovered, and the men that were with him, now Saul abode in Gibeah under a tree in Ramah, having his spear in his hand, and all his servants were standing about him, then Saul said unto his servants that stood about him, Hear now, ye Benjamites, will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards, and make you all captains of thousands and captains of hundreds? That all of you have conspired against me, and there is none that showeth me that my son hath made a league with the son of Jesse, and there is none of you that is sorry for me, or showeth unto me that my son hath stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as it this day. Then answered Doeg the Edomite, which was set over the servants of Saul, and said, I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob, to Ahimelech, son of Ahitub. And he inquired of the Lord for him, and gave him victuals, and gave him the sword of Goliath of Philistine. Then the king sent to call Ahimelech the priest, the son of Ahitub, and all his father's house. The priest put he with the edge of the sword, both men and women, children and sucklings, and oxen and asses and sheep with the edge of the sword. And one of the sons of Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, named Abiathar, escaped and fled after David. And Abiathar showed David that Saul had slain the Lord's priest. And David said unto Abiathar, I knew it that day, when Doeg the Edomite was there, that he would surely tell Saul, I have occasioned the death of all the persons of thy father's house. Abide thou with me, fear not, for he that seeketh my life seeketh thy life, but with me thou shalt be in safeguard. Last week we noticed that God took David to the cave of Adullam after his initial flight in panic, one direction and another. We followed David from his service in the household of Saul to Ramah, and from Ramah back to Gibeah, and from Gibeah to Nob, and from Nob to Gath, and now from Gath to the cave at Adullam. And it is here that the tempo of David's life changes radically. And there's a whole new chapter that opens up in his experience. No longer would David, like a lonely deer, chased hither and yon, take flight at night to escape the sword of Saul. For at Adullam God gathered to David 400 men, we see in verse 2. And if you look in chapter 23 and verse 13, you'll find that it wasn't very long before there were 600 men gathered to his side, to his standard. And here begins an exciting chapter in the life of David, an absolutely fascinating lifestyle that he was living. And it's so exciting that really the story deserves to be told as a story, and there must be some profit when you see the storytelling of the Old Testament, there must be some profit to the soul to remember God's dealings just in the story. As it comes across, the new situation that David finds himself in is so filled with adventure and with action that I think sometimes in our reading in the King James we don't grasp all that's happening. The story is so fascinating that it really deserves to be told without comment, the kind of comment and drawing of lessons that we usually give in sermons, but you can be sure we won't be able to do that. Nevertheless, this evening, because this new chapter in the life of David has opened to us, we're going to concentrate in the story of it as we find it in the Old Testament. Because really, there is one account of it in Samuel, there is another account of it in Chronicles, and there are even certain things about this period of his life that are told in 2 Samuel. At the end of the account of David's wanderings in the wilderness, and of being king, so that to put these things together, it's necessary almost simply to tell the story. David, you must know, was still a very young man, about the age of college graduates today, as he went to the cave at Adullam. And he was gathering around him men who were also young like himself. And these men were full of the vigor of youth and full of that spirit that we often find in young people to hurl themselves with all of their energies and with almost complete abandon into the thing that is before them. And all the while that they were in the cave of Adullam and in the forest of Judah that's called the forest of Hereth, they were hunted and pursued by the evil and mad King Saul. They were sort of in the mountainous forest land, much as you may find some of the guerrilla forces of certain lands in our own day, where they wandered about as they forced unto themselves. And as they roamed the wilds to avoid the capture that was unjust, they won the hearts of the nation to themselves. They won the people and their respect and their love. There was in the whole force of David and his men a very strict discipline so that they never touched the belongings. They never ravaged the people of Judah. And yet, this land of Judah was left unprotected by Saul. Saul was the king. He was supposed to be fighting the battles against the Philistines. And yet Saul, the madman, was so intent on his unjust purposes of putting to death innocent men like David, and probably he wasn't the only one, Saul was so intent on that he ignored the Philistines. And again, the military bands of the Philistines began to roam through the land of the Jews. And especially in the times of harvest, they would come and leave a corps of Philistine soldiers at this city and at that city. And then as soon as the harvest were brought in, they would go and demand a portion, and probably a large portion, of the goods from the people of God. Well, David and his men would sweep out of the forest, or out of the caves where they were hiding, and inflict stunning defeat upon the Philistines time after time, to deliver the Jews from the plundering of their crops unjustly from these foreign invaders. And then they would disappear again back into the wilderness to escape for their lives. And never throughout this whole period of time, never did they ever do what we read of Robin Hood doing, robbing from the rich to give to the poor. Absolutely not. They wouldn't do that sort of thing. Never did they attack the government or the establishment. David absolutely forbade his men ever to harm Saul or his troops or the powers that were brought into being by God Almighty, because he feared the God who put Saul in power. And yet there was all the dashing and daring in reality and in life that you could ever read about in the novels about Robin Hood. Protecting the people of God, and at the same time avoiding unjust oppression for themselves. Now in 2 Samuel 23 and 1 Chronicles 11, we're given glimpses of the mighty men who came to join David in this band in the forest and in the cave. The men who were with him in these swashbuckling days of excitement. There were of these 600 very valiant men. I mean, they were genuine heroes, and they were heroes in their own time. And I'm sure that the people sang about these folk heroes the way they sang about David, that he has slain his 10,000. Men who won the hearts of Israel for David, and men who, in effect, established David's kingdom among the Jews. Now, as you read the history of David, you must not get the impression that suddenly Saul died and the people thought, well, who are we going to have for a king? And they looked around and it came to somebody's mind that they ought to pick David. David, over periods of years before Saul was slain, was winning the hearts of the Jews. And he had an organized band of men who established him in the power and in favor with the people of Israel. Among these 600, there was an elite corps of champions who eventually became his captains and his leaders in the position of government when he came to power. And they were called the 30, although this band of the elite corps, probably they were captains over the rest of the 600, these 30 eventually numbered more than the 30, but they were called the 30 nonetheless. And as the stories are told about the heroes who formed the band of the 30, you can begin to imagine the lifestyle of David and the men who were with him in the forest and in the caves. Benaiah, once faced an Egyptian who was over 9 feet tall and who had a spear as large as a weaver's beam. Benaiah at the time was carrying only a staff in his hand, a stick. And yet Benaiah went on the attack after that Egyptian who was a seasoned warrior with this huge implement of war. And on the attack he seized the spear out of his hand and slew the Egyptian with his own weapon. The story was told and recorded in the Word of God. Eleazar, one of these number of the 30, one day was the first of the band to come upon the Philistine army. And apparently he was sent ahead for the purpose of intelligence, and instead of serving as a forerunner to take a message back to the troops, when he arrived where the Philistine army was found, he saw that the Philistines were poised for attack, and they were about to assault one of the cities of Judah. And there were no other soldiers round to join with him. And instead of taking this information back to the 600 who were with David, Eleazar, all by himself, single-handedly, attacked the Philistine army. And he cut right and left with his sword, we read in the story, until the sword clave to his hand, and it was like his arm was so stiff with the battle that his arm and the sword was one. And before ever the rest of the troops arrived, the whole of the Philistine army was routed by the attack of one man. And the rest of them just did the mopping up operation and pursued the Philistines who were in flight. Jashobeam, one of the 30, killed 300 Philistines in one day with a spear. Can you imagine the physical strength that was involved in one battle, single-handedly, to kill 300 men? He wasn't using a rifle, you know, just pulling the trigger. He was using a spear. This was hand-to-hand combat. How they must have sat around in the forest of Herod and in the cave of Adullam, recounting their raids and their battles and their heroic feats and praising God for what he had done by them. But these were men who thirsted for action and excitement. They were young men who were still in the vigor of youth. One winter day, they found a lion that was down in the pit. The snow had covered the ground, we read, at that particular time. And in a flash, Benaiah, we already talked about him, Benaiah climbed down into the pit and with his hand weapon slew the lion. You can imagine the brief moment in which there was anxiety in the rest of them as they watched Benaiah go down into the danger of facing a lion eye to eye. And then the cheers as he slew the lion. Then the back slapping, going back into the camp and recounting to everyone else what Benaiah had done that day. I wonder if it was necessary. But there was this thirst for action. There was this courage. There was this activity in the young men that surrounded David. And the warm mutual love and respect grew among these men. It was present from the first. We've read that David came to the cave at Adullam, and while they were still at the cave, there were three of that 30, that elite band of leaders, who overheard David one day and a whimsical thought that had come across his mind. David said, "Oh, that one would give me a drink of water of the well of Bethlehem that is at the gate. Oh, I wish I could have a drink from that well that I used to drink from when I was a boy and a shepherd and coming back into Bethlehem." And it was the time of harvest, and one of the Philistine corps were camped at Bethlehem. And the three men talked it over after they heard David talking. And it was a whim on David's part, and he wasn't asking anyone to do it, but they said, "Come on, let's go. Let's go see if we can't fool those old Philistines. They're sitting there at Bethlehem. We'll take them on all by ourselves and bring David a bottle of water and really surprise him." And they broke through the ranks of the Philistines. Apparently battle was involved. And they got a bottle of water and they brought it back to David because they loved David. Here was their leader. He wanted a little drink of water from a well. They risked their lives to get it and brought it back. And when he heard the story, David had such respect for them that he said, "If your blood was risked for this, I can't possibly drink it." And he poured it out as an offering unto God because it was precious, because these men had risked their lives. And you begin to get the feeling of the real affection that was between David and his men. Perhaps it was the visit of these three heroes to Bethlehem that left word with David and his family that David was at the cave at Adullam. Whether that's so or not, we read in verse 1 that they fled from the Philistines and they fled from Saul and they came to the cave of Adullam, his mother, his father, his brethren, to dwell with David. And David realized that his aging mother and father couldn't live the kind of lifestyle that they were living. They couldn't run through the forest and live in caves and sweep out to attack the enemy and go on the run from Saul again. And so David took them to Moab. And he personally appealed to the king of Moab to protect them. After all, Jesse's grandmother was a Moabitess. Ruth, you remember. And David had respect for his parents. He honored his father and mother. He was not too busy, even here, to take care of them. The whole growing army went with David. And when David went to stand before the king of Moab, it wasn't like the day he stood before the king of Gath, Achish, the Philistine. He was all alone there except for one or two who were with him, and he had to play the madman and run. But when David stood in Moab on a nearby hillside were his 600 men, fully armed, a small but a mighty band that attended him. And I don't know if the king of Moab was very thrilled to have David and his soldiers in his own territory, but he respected him if he wasn't delighted that he was there. The story is told, I think, because it was here at Moab that one of the prominent men of God joined David and his ranks. This was Gad, the seer, the prophet. Perhaps he was schooled by Samuel at Ramah. Perhaps David met him when he was at that school of the prophets for a period of time. But at any rate, God sent the prophet with a message that we read in verse 5. Gad said to David, "Do not stay here in the hold, in this strong military position in Moab, probably a mountainous height of some sort that could not easily be attacked. Do not stay in the hold. Depart and get into the land of Judah." Then David departed and came into the forest of Herod. You see, David was going to be the king. And David could not be exiled. He had to win the hearts of the people. And God still had a job for David to do while he himself was running from Saul to defeat the Philistines. Saul wasn't going to do the job. And so he returned to the forest of Herod. And from that day, these lively soldiers had a chaplain, Gad, the seer, And we read as we go through the story of David that Gad became the seer of David. He was the right-hand prophet of David who attended him. While in the forest of Harith, that mountainous timberland, another visitor arrived in the camp. Another righteous man who walked with God and who was going to give great spiritual comfort to David. He arrived in the camp, and when he did, you can be sure it put an end to any of the spirited joy and the stories that they must have been telling about their heroic events that may have accompanied the men when he arrived. It put an end to that.
Please turn over the cassette at this point and continue the message.
that may have accompanied the men when he arrived. It put an end to that. He had a tale to recount that would make all very quiet and solemn. It would renew the sober realization that their life was more than roaming the woods and baiting lions and fighting Philistines. There was something very somber on the horizon. Outrage and dismay would fill their hearts to learn of the visitor's account of recent events at the court of Saul. The new arrival was Abiathar, who had just become the chief priest of the people of God. And of course, they would have welcomed any priest with the spirit that David had. David would not touch Saul, the anointed of the Lord. And surely the godly priests would be received with great hospitality. Perhaps the priest ate heartily before he began to talk. Perhaps he was too heartsick to eat anything and just began to pour out his heart to David, probably the 30, as they sat around the campfire to hear him. But solemnity and silence came increasingly upon the camp as they heard the story of Abiathar. A few days before, Saul had convened his court in the open air on a hill near Gibeah. The king was seated under a tree with his spear in his hand. And no doubt those who stood around him watched that spear very warily. David had learned that he could hurl it on impulse at anyone who displeased him. It was the first time that Saul had convened his court since he had learned that David had an army and was camped in the wilderness. And you know that Saul had a conspiracy mentality. Behind every piece of bad news, he thought there was a plot against him. That's a terrible thing. It's an unspiritual attitude. And it just eats out the insides of a man. And sometimes you find this among evangelicals. They see a plot here and a conspiracy there. For often this happens to people who have a conservative bent of mind. Christian, beware of that attitude that every time something goes wrong, there's a terrible plot behind it somewhere. It's near to insanity itself. Saul had this mentality, wicked suspicion of everything. He opened his mouth to begin the session. "Hear now, ye Benjamites." I'm sure there was harshness in his voice. But it's interesting, all the men who were in his court and around him were Benjamites from his own tribe. He wouldn't have anybody from any of the other tribes serve around him. He'd be sure that they would serve with David. They would go over to the enemy's camp. So everybody around him in the courtroom were from his own tribe, almost his own relatives, Benjamites, people who would be on his side. But now he even suspected them. "Hear now, ye Benjamites." He had their attention. "What has this son of Jesse promised to you? Is he going to give you fields? What's he talking about? Is he going to give you vineyards? Ah, he's promised you positions in the army when he comes to power, hasn't he?" You can imagine the men standing around. Here's the king saying, "Listen to me, I know what's going on. I know what's happening. David's promised you something, hasn't he? What has he paid to enlist in the conspiracy against me?" And they were stunned and there was silence. Nobody dared to answer. "What's this madman going to do? Ha ha, you didn't think I was going to find out, did you? I know that every one of you is in on the plot. And I have the perfect proof that you're all against me." What was his proof? "Not one of you ever told me that Jonathan planned the rebellion against me." You see what's going on in the madman's mind. And he's just spilling it out in the court to his people. "None of you ever told... You all knew about it, didn't you? You all knew that Jonathan set David against me, and he put David out there, and he planned how David was going to attack me. And you all knew about it, and not one of you ever pitied me and told me about it." How does a sane man answer that kind of a thing? What were they to say to him? David wasn't laying in wait for Saul, and Jonathan didn't plot for his father's death, and none of them had ever heard any such thing in the court. That wasn't even the rumor of the courtroom. Does ignorance of what's going on make a man an accomplice in treason? What in the world would you say if you were before a king who accused you of such a thing? Well, there was one man there that knew what to say, Doeg the Edomite. There was a certain memory that flashed into his mind, and he blurted it out. I remember when David went to Nob. Yeah, he went up to see the priest there in Ahimelech. Ahimelech gave him food to eat and gave him a sword, and he inquired of the Urim and Thummim what David should do. And the king took this new piece of intelligence in typical fashion. In anger, he roared out that not only Ahimelech, but all the priests must appear before him immediately. And soon, they were all there, 85 priests, in their linen ephods, the symbol of their office before the Lord. And Ahimelech, you must know, as the high priest, held the second highest office in the whole land, second only to Saul himself. But Saul addressed him with rude contempt. Thou son of Ahitub. But he received a polite response from his subject. Behold me, my lord. What is it, my lord? Why did you conspire with David to seek my life? You're involved in supporting a treasonous uprising. Ahimelech said, David is your son-in-law. David's always been the most faithful servant you have. You often sent David up to the tabernacle to inquire of the Lord for the purposes that you were sending him on. I didn't just start to have anything to do with David when David was conspiring against you. I never heard anything about the conspiracy. We don't know anything about it. That was exact truth. But Saul was beyond wanting any truth. He just wanted people to fall in with his view of things. Thou shalt surely die in all thy father's house. And immediately the guard was commanded to kill all of the priests. And he stood there in amazement. And nobody obeyed. Here was holy disobedience, and there is a time for it. There is a time to disobey and not follow out the will of a madman when it's evident to everybody that he doesn't know what he's doing. But Doeg, the Ishmaelite, had no such fear of Jehovah. And he fell on the priests and killed all 85 of them. And that was unholy obedience. There's a time when it's sin to obey even those who are over you. It's interesting to see that Saul, who could not, a few chapters earlier, he could not bring himself to kill all of the cattle of the Amalekites, and because he would not kill all the cattle of the Amalekites, and he would not kill the king of the Amalekites, he was rejected from being the servant of God. Suddenly, he's willing to wipe out the entire village of the priests of the Most High God and kill their cattle and their infants, and everyone. And none was left alive but Abiathar, who escaped with the ephod and the Urim and Thummim, and the new high priest went to be with David. As David heard the story, there was a mixture of anger and sorrow that filled his soul. Notice what he said in verse 22. David said to Abiathar, I knew it. That day when Doeg the Edomite was there, I knew that he would surely tell Saul, I know Doeg. I've been in the house of Saul. I know what kind of man he is, grasping after power, looking for some way to get more money and influence in the kingdom. I knew he'd tell Saul. And then this bitterness of spirit, I have occasioned the death of all the persons of thy father's household. David, you remember just earlier in Achish had pretended to be a madman. Saul didn't need to pretend. He was a madman. And that night under the stars, with an agitated mind, David composed a psalm. I'd like you to turn to the psalm, Psalm 52. Look at the psalm that David composed after hearing this story in his own camp. keep in mind as we read Psalm 52 that the wicked person that David is talking about is Doeg the Edomite, who did this terrible thing. He was the one not only who occasioned the death of the priests, he actually executed them all, carried out the devastation in Nob. Psalm 52. Why boastest thou thyself in mischief, O mighty man? The goodness of God endureth continually. Thy tongue deviseth mischiefs, like a sharp razor working deceitfully. Thou lovest evil more than good, and lying rather than to speak righteousness. Thou lovest all devouring words, O thou deceitful tongue. This is all Doeg. God shall likewise destroy thee forever. Do you ever think when you saw terrible wickedness oppressing other people that the wrath of God is a comforting doctrine? When David thought of all the men of God slain by Doeg, he was comforted to think God will destroy you forever. He shall take thee away and pluck thee out of thy dwelling place and root thee out of the land of the living. The righteous also shall see and fear and shall laugh at him. Lo, this is the man that made not God his strength, but trusted in the abundance of his riches and strengthened himself in his wickedness. But I am like a green olive tree in the house of God. I trust in the mercy of God forever and ever. I will praise thee forever because thou hast done it, and I will wait on thy name, for it is good before thy saints. Doeg had lied. David talks about that deceitful tongue. How did Doeg lie? I want you to see the lie of Doeg in verses 9 and 10 back in 1 Samuel 22. Doeg said, I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub. Isn't that true? That's truth. That's the truth. And he inquired of him, or inquired of the Lord for him. We don't read about that in the earlier verses, but that could very well be true. And Ahimelech doesn't deny it, so apparently it was true. He inquired of the Lord for him. He gave him food. That's true. He gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine. That's true. Where's the lie? Where's the lie of Doeg the Edomite? The lie of Doeg the Edomite was telling truth in the wrong context. He knew exactly what Saul was thinking with that conspiracy mentality. He knew exactly how Saul would take this information, and he did nothing to correct Saul's impression of what that meant. Even speaking the truth in the wrong context, when you know that people are going to take the wrong thing from it, is lying and deceit, and you're responsible for it. David took comfort in the vengeance of God that would destroy this scoundrel. And he renewed his own confidence in the Lord. Now, most of the hour has been spent in just telling some of the story of these times of David, but I'd like to make just a couple applications as we end. And in particular, I'd like to speak to the young men. To the young men. When you read of this chapter in the life of David, it ought to make your blood boil. It ought to make you enthusiastic to do something for God in your generation. To flex your muscles for truth and for righteousness. To attempt to do great feats for God. You know, you see young men like David and the men who surrounded him, who hurled themselves into the Philistines, did great things. Escaped back into the forest, so that they themselves would not be tracked down by Saul. Let me ask you, when you see the enemies of truth,
When you see the enemies of righteousness that are assembled, and you walk into work and you see men, and everybody's against the truth, and nobody's standing for righteousness, or you walk into the classroom in school, what do? Do you hang your head and walk out and say, well, what's one fellow against all of this? Look, some of these guys slew 300 in one day, believing in God and just hurling themselves into the midst of the enemy. They got into the fight. They didn't even wait for the rest of the army to come. They didn't say, what can one man do against all of the Philistines? They said, I got one sword and I'm going at it. And they went at it and they did something for the Lord. Trust in the sword of God's word until your hand is cleaving to it, and cut one way and another against the evils of our day and against the lack of knowledge of doctrine and the ungodly theories that are being propounded. And do something and throw yourself into it, and who can tell whether God would do mighty things through heroes in our day as He did in that day. Speak to one another about your exploits and begin to take comfort in those who love a good fight for the cause of God. You see, there is something beautiful in youth, and there is something good in all of that enthusiasm and zeal, and it ought to be all channeled into the work of God and into the work of His kingdom. And though I tell you, if you get into it, you'll start loving the people who do those things, and you'll be daring for the gospel, and you'll use the beauties of youth not for adventure's sake, not adventure for adventure's sake, but you'll start devising ways to do something for God and for His glory. And when vicious attacks are made on you and on your Lord, and your heart grows sick with the injustice, learn to pray. Learn to pray like David prayed. For solace comes in meditating on who God is. And I'll tell you, there's glory in the doctrine of God's justice and the doctrine of His vengeance that's going to be poured out upon those who destroy the bodies and the souls of men. And if you've ever been in the fight against them, you'll find some comfort in these things. Learn to cast yourself on the Lord and to make Him your trust.